Hello, ladies and gentlemen. This is Dan Trotter, Pretty Good Bible Studies. I am covering in this audio Exodus chapter 22, verses 16 through 31. Our context is this. In the last part of Exodus 22, verses 1 through 15, we cover the law of theft, torts involving property, and bailments. And in this section, verses 16 through 31, I'm going to cover sexual sins, orphans, usury, and collateral. We start now in verses 16 and 17 of Exodus 22. If a man seduces a virgin who is not engaged, and he sleeps with her, he must certainly pay the bridal price for her to be his wife. If her father absolutely refuses to give her to him, he must pay an amount in silver equal to the bridal price for virgins. Now, I'm going to combine this law with the related law in Deuteronomy 22, verses 23 through 29, and we're going to look at the laws concerning sexual situations involving women. We're going to start with single women, then we're going to talk about engaged women, and then we're going to talk about raped women. Well, first of all, let's talk about this word engaged. Verse 16 involves a virgin who is not engaged. She's seduced and she is not engaged. What does engaged mean? Well, other translations like the KJV has betrothed. The NIV has pledged to be married. The NASB has engaged, just like the Holman Christian Study Bible. Engaged and betrothed is not a dime's worth of difference between the two words. The words are used interchangeably in the translations. The difference, however, is in Western culture and in biblical culture. There was a big difference in betrayal and marriage, not in betrothal and engagement per se, but between what a betrothal was or what an engagement was. I call it a betrothal slash engagement, what it was compared to marriage. Now, in the Western world, a betrothal or an engagement is much easier to break. It often involves an agreement between a man and a woman to get married. There's no other legal obligations involved. The parents don't even have to get involved. But in biblical times, a betrothal was much more serious. There was a formal contract written up between the two families, and that contract was as binding as a marriage would be. So in the West, if you break up an engagement, it's sad, and people cry and say boo-hoo, and they put "so sorry" on your Facebook page and so forth. But by golly, in the Old Testament times, in the biblical times, New Testament as well, the parties, the families, signed a contract. And that contract was binding. And also there were dowry or bride price arrangements made between the parties. Dowry being money brought into the marriage by the bride, and a bride price being money brought into the marriage by the husband, depending on how it went. And if you broke that, it's the same thing as getting a divorce. So getting out of a biblical betrothal slash engagement, the same thing as getting divorced. In fact, you were practically married. The only difference was you couldn't have sex. That's a big difference, I guess. But back then, you know, there was not a lot of romance. It was a business arrangement. The idea the parties had was that after their young people got married, they would learn to love with each other as they lived their lives together. And as they had sex together, there would be bonds that built up and they would be happily married. I used to think that was much superior than the way that we do it here in the West, which is disastrous. But then I lived in China for so long and I saw the disastrous results of parent arranged marriages in China, and now I'm not so hot on arranged marriages. The only answer to marriages is, by golly, both of the parties better be praying an awful lot. It's all I can say, however the society arranges it. All right, our two verses here, Exodus 22, verses 16 and 17, deal with unbetrothed single women who are seduced. Now we're going to look at the law for betrothed women who are not single and who have sex with another man, and a raped woman who has sex with another man. This is in Deuteronomy 22, 23 through 29. If there is a girl who is a virgin engaged to a man, and another man finds her in the city and lies with her, then you shall bring them both out to the gate of the city, and you shall stone them to death. The girl, because she did not cry out in the city, and that means she was deliberately engaging in sex while she was engaged to another man, and she didn't cry out, that means she wasn't raped. And the man, because he has violated his neighbor's wife. Notice, a betrothed woman, which who we would call a fiance, they call, the law here calls a wife, because betrothal was very serious. It's like being married. Thus she shall purge the evil from among you. But if in the field the man finds the girl who is engaged, and the man forces her and lies with her, then only the man who lies with her shall die. But you shall do nothing to the girl. There's no sin in the girl worthy of death, for just as a man rises against his neighbor and murders him, so is this case. When he found her in the field, the engaged girl cried out, but there was no one to save her. Now, of course, that's a matter of evidence. I don't know how you hear a girl in the wood in the field getting raped, but it's a matter of evidence. If it turns out the girl was raped, then of course nothing happens to her. If a man finds a girl who is a virgin who is not engaged and seizes her and lies with her, and they're discovered, now this is a rape. He seizes her. This is not a seduction, as in Exodus 22, our verses. This is a rape, different situation. Then the man who lay with her shall give to the girl's father 50 shekels of silver, and she shall become his wife because he has violated her. He cannot divorce her all these days. Now, you put these two laws together, and it gets kind of complicated because there's so many permutations and combinations of situations that can occur. So I've summarized them here. We can have a situation with a girl who is engaged and she fornicates without being raped, or she can be engaged and be raped. Or we can have a girl who's not engaged and she fornicates without being raped, or she's not engaged and she is raped. Those four situations. So let's look at them. First of all, if the girl is engaged and she fornicates without being raped, in other words, she's seduced basically, well, she's stoned to death and the man is stoned to death. Ooh, that's serious business. That interferes with somebody else's marriage. Because she's engaged in a betrothal, just like being married. So it's very similar to adultery. But now if she is engaged and is raped, she is completely unpunished. And the rapist is executed. Of course, that's obvious. There's nothing difficult about that. Now, if the girl is not engaged and she fornicates without being raped, that means she was seduced, basically. I assume she was seduced. Maybe she seduced the guy. I don't know. But it doesn't matter. Exodus 22, verses 16 through 17 applies. And our verses show that she either gets the man as a husband, depending on her father's permission, or her father gets the equivalent to a bride price from the man. So the person who seduces a single girl, he's got to pay a bride price. He's got to pay a bride price and get the bride, or if the father doesn't allow the girl to marry him, then he has to pay the equivalent of the bride price, and he loses the girl, all up to the father and his daughter. Now let's take the fourth situation. If a girl is not engaged and she's raped, this is in Deuteronomy 22 here, the rapist is forced to marry her, plus he must pay 50 shekels to her father. Now, this is a problem here because you can think to yourself, how is this fair to the girl? She's raped and now she's got to marry the rapist. It's true that her father gets 50 shekels, which I think is a good bit of money, but still. Well, there's some possible answers to that. These are all my speculations. I haven't read anything on this. I'm sure there's stuff out there, but all my commentators went blank. Here's one possibility. The rapist would probably know the girl because I don't think they really had a chance of having random rapes. I mean, they didn't have an urban society where women are walking around in the city at night and going to bars and going down dark alleys where they can get raped. They were pretty sequestered in the homes, protected by their brothers and fathers, so you're not going to have drive-by rapists. So probably this is a situation where the girl knows the rapist. The rapist decides gets too hot for her, and the girl's trying to preserve her honor, and the guy forces her. But if that's the case, at least the man is in love, so there's a chance at a happy marriage. And so if the law forces the man to marry her and not leave her in the lurch, violated with no chance of a future marriage, well, that's a just result. I mean, think about it. If the rapist is not forced to marry the girl, she's no longer a virgin on the marriage market, what chance is she going to have? Who's going to want to marry a girl who's lost her virginity and been raped? And there was no job market for single women in that society. Of course, she would be stuck to live with her father or her mother for the rest of her life in shame with no children. And children were a big deal back then. Now, let's say that you have the situation where the daughter does not want to marry the rapist. Now, the law here says that the rapist shall become the girl's wife. He cannot divorce her all of his days. I'm assuming that's when the girl wants to marry him. But if the girl doesn't want to marry him, I'm assuming that the father has the right to veto the rapist as a husband. And the commentator Ellicott agrees with me on that. He says this, quote, "It seems, however, from Exodus 22:17, that the girl's father might forbid the marriage, though the seducer could not escape from it in any other way." And I think that's perfectly just. In other words, we reason by analogy from Exodus 22:17. We have a seduced girl. Her father can forbid the marriage of the seduced girl and the seducer. Likewise, by analogy, doesn't it make sense that a raped girl's father could refuse the marriage of the rapist and his daughter? That makes perfectly good sense. So, and in any rate, the rapist is forced to pay 50 shekels to the father, which is a good heap bit of money. So The law is not, it might look unjust on the surface, but I don't think it, of course it's not unjust. God made the law for that situation in that society. Very briefly, I'm going to look at four situations. Situation number one, the girl is engaged and she fornicates. Situation number two, the girl is engaged, she's raped. Situation number three, the girl is not engaged, she fornicates. Situation number four, the girl is not engaged, she's raped. So four situations. Situation number one, she's engaged, she fornicates. She's stoned to death, the man is stoned to death. If she is engaged and she's raped by another party, then she is completely unpunished and the rapist is executed. That's situation two. Situation three, the girl is not engaged. She's single. She fornicates without being raped. Exodus 22:16-17 applies. She either gets the man as a husband, depending on her father's permission, or her father gets the equivalent to a bride price from the man. In either case, the seducer pays the buy price. All right, that's situation number three. The girl's not engaged and she fornicates. Now, if she's not engaged and she's raped, the rapist is forced to marry her plus pay 50 shekels to her father. And I've talked about how I think that's a good situation. It's not a good situation, but how it's a just solution to a very bad problem. And the law is perfectly reasonable in that case. Now, let's look at verse 16 in Exodus 22 a little deeper. The seducer is of a single girl, can either marry the girl or not marry the girl, depending on the father's decision. Now, let's look at that a little closer. Let's say the seducer wants to marry her. In that case, the father can either consent or not consent. Well, if the seducer wants to marry the single girl and the father consents, then the seducer pays the bride price, the man and woman marry, and hopefully they'll live happily ever after. But what if the seducer wants to marry the girl and the father does not consent? Well, the seducer pays the bride price and the man and woman do not marry. Well, that's just, you shouldn't have seduced a single girl. You're completely at the mercy of the father. And the father might say, this man's a Bill Clinton, a Casanova. I don't trust him. He seduced my daughter. And if I had a firearm available, which we don't have back in the ancient times, but if I had one, I'd aim it right between his lusty eyes. All right, that's two possibilities. What about if the seducer does not want to marry the girl and the father wants him to marry his daughter? Now, there's a split of opinion on what happens in this situation. Can the father force an unwilling seducer to marry the girl? Adam Clark says yes, the seducer is forced to marry the girl. Here's an emphasis, a quotation from Clark. The person who might feel inclined to take the advantage of a young woman knew that he must marry her and give her a dowry. Now, of course, the problem there is you got an unwilling seducer. Sure, financially he takes care of the woman, but what about emotionally? He seduces her, he looks down on her, the woman's not happy. Well, at least she's financially taken care of. Now, how does Clark know that the seducer must marry the girl? Well, he might make an analogy with Deuteronomy 22:29, where a rapist of an engaged girl was forced to marry the girl. So that's how Clark might come up with that solution. John Gill disagrees with Clark, and he says an unwilling seducer is not forced to marry her. I don't know how Gill came to that, but perhaps his reasoning is thus. To force an unwilling rapist to marry would doom the girl to unhappiness. And I think that's true. Now, the unwilling girl, she got seduced. She wasn't raped, so she participated in this fornication. And if her father says, no, your seducer doesn't want to marry you, you're not going to be happy. I'm going to not let you marry him. I'm not going to force him to marry you. You're just going to have to live with the consequences of your sin. You shouldn't have been seduced. Here's 50 shekels. Have a nice life, or something to that effect. Now, in all this, I am assuming, as most people do, that the father does not make unilateral, willy-nilly decisions without taking into consideration his daughter's desires as to whether she marries the seducer or not. Surely he's going to take his daughter's desires into that. What father wouldn't? We go down to Exodus 22:18. You shall not allow a sorceress to live. You notice it's a woman. Of course, that's true of warlocks, too. It's just that they were more women sorcerers than there were men. And I don't know why that is. Even today, there's more witches than warlocks. Female sorcerers were mentioned in this verse because there were so many of them. But of course, wizards and warlocks are included in this prohibition. They would not be allowed to live either. Now, when it says you should not allow a sorceress to live, this assumes a judicial process. It doesn't mean that you can go out and find a witch and bump them off privately. there were no bounties on witches that you go in and just take them out. Now, here's a query. Does this law seem excessively severe to kill a witch or a warlock? Here's what Adam Clark says. From the severity of this law against witches, etc., we may see in what light these were viewed by divine justice. They were seducers of the people from their allegiance to God, on whose judgment alone they should depend, and by impiously prying into futurity, assumed an attribute of God, the foretelling of future events, which implied in itself the grossest blasphemy, and tended to corrupt the minds of the people by leading them away from God and the revelation he had made of himself. Many of the Israelites had no doubt learned these curious arts from their long residence with the Egyptians, and so much were the Israelites attached to them that we find such arts and repute among them, and in various practices of this kind prevail through the whole of the Jewish history. Notwithstanding, the offense was capital, and in all cases punished with death. So yeah, people love to get the power of the devil. They love to be witches. So I don't have any problem with the severity of the law to knock off a witch. Now, what about the Salem witchcraft trials in the 17th century in America? They were an absolute disaster, mainly because of factual problems. They accused people who weren't witches, and the judicial process broke down. And if you read the stories of the Salem witchcraft trials, I guarantee you there was demonic activity fooling people. People were seeing things that weren't really there. They were seeing apparitions. Oh, it's a witch. And pretty soon there's gross hysteria everywhere. And the judicial system broke down and condemned innocent people. Of course, that's a disaster. Well, here's a couple of gross errors the Puritans committed in creating this disaster. First, they said that the New Testament church was mixed with the state. Bad mistake. The Old Testament law is not applicable to the New Testament church. Covenant theology would have saved them. Reformed theology screwed them up. Covenant theology screwed them up. Theonomist theology screwed them up. That's the first problem. New Testament church is not mixed with the state. Well, the first problem is the state and the church, that the state and the church were both subject to the Old Testament law. The church is not subject to the Old Testament law, so the church had no business dealing with witches with capital punishment. They could not use the Old Testament law as sanction for that. That's one problem. The other problem is that the church is mixed with the state. Couldn't tell the two apart in Puritan society, and so the state got involved and condemned innocent women to death as witches. Total, and what a PR disaster. Atheists are blasting Christians with that even to this day. They'll never stop. We go to Exodus 22, verse 19. Whoever lies with an animal shall surely be put to death. Now, bestiality was very evil for more than one reason. First of all, it violated the natural order, as John Gill says, quote, "This is a crime so detestable and abominable, so shocking and dishonorable to human nature, that one would think it could never be committed by any of the human species." Well, John Gill hasn't met Americans, and that there was no occasion for making a law against it. But such is the depravity and corruption of mankind that divine wisdom saw it necessary. Yes, sir, mankind is depraved and corrupt enough to do this. I remember when I was sent to a Presbyterian youth camp to try to get some Christianity into my rebellious soul. And I went to this youth camp, and there was a guy, I remember he had red hair, I forgot his name. But I'll never forget it. I think he was about a year older than me, and he was bragging about how he had sex with horses. I'd never heard of such a thing. I said, this is Christianity? This is the church? That's one reason why I probably left that church in a state of high dudgeon. That's probably why I have trouble stepping foot in the Presbyterian church to this day, because of that memory. Bestiality is disgusting. Now, of course, you know, if you live in a society where there are no sexual norms, i.e., as in present day America, the United States of Sodom and Gomorrah, well, then sex with trees, ducks, animals, horses, donkeys, same-sex, thruples, you name it, some American is going to try to do something perverted. What's the best way if you want to rebel against God? Rebel against the very precious gift of human sexuality and marriage that he's given us, and you will see society break down. You will see families break down. You will see people living in absolute misery, and that's what we've got here in America today. But people will still glorify, oh, I just love him so much. We went off to the hotel and had sex all weekend. Wasn't it wonderful? He gave me a flower. Yeah, and what are the odds are that liaison's going to last more than 2 or 3 weeks? Now, this bestiality that is condemned here in the law, it was often connected with idolatry. As the NIV Study Bible says, quote, ancient myths and epics described acts of bestiality performed by pagan gods and demigods in Babylon and Canaan. They probably didn't put the pictures of that in the textbooks. I wasn't aware of that, but bestiality is bad, folks. At least in America, I think we still think it's evil, but I don't know how long it's going to last. I think incest is going to be the next thing that falls. People are going to say, oh, but it's a loving relationship. I love my brother. I love my sister. I want to have sex with them. I just saw in New York State, somebody sued somebody else who was in the court system where a father wanted to marry his daughter because they loved each other. It's an act of love. Oh, and you love your dog. Oh, it's an act of love. I want to have sex with it. People like that, quite frankly, deserve to get blasted off the face of the earth by an offended God. I got no problem with that. New Testament, Old Testament, anytime, I don't care. There's no excuse for the depravity of human beings. And the law was holy. It was designed to show what was not holy, and bestiality was one of the things that was decidedly not holy. Exodus 22, verse 20, our next verse. He who sacrifices to any god other than to the Lord alone shall be utterly destroyed. That means killed. NIV noted this verse says this, quote, the Hebrew term for destroyed, refers to the irrevocable giving over of things who are persons to the Lord, often by totally destroying them. I think that's Korban. I'm not dead sure. Now, this command to kill any idolater, to execute any idolater, is in line with God's later command to destroy all the idolatrous Canaanites. And I've got about 11 dozen scriptures here where God says, destroy them, wipe them out. Now, of course, skeptics often choke at how God could be so mean. Oh, it's terrible. He's a genocidalist. He committed genocide on the Canaanites. And I have a short answer to these morons. Would you, dear skeptic, would you choke at what the Allies did to the Nazis? Came in there and wiped them out? Would you choke at the Nuremberg trials for executing these monsters? I mean, these Canaanites that were wiped out, they were sacrificing their kids to idols, for crying out loud. I don't have any sympathy for liberal skeptics. They're nothing but blasphemers with a PhD attached to their name. Exodus 22, verses 21 through 24. You shall not wrong a stranger or oppress him, for you were strangers in the land of Egypt. You shall not afflict any widow or orphan. If you afflict him at all, and if he does cry out to me, I will surely hear his cry, and my anger will be kindled. And I will kill you with a sword, and your wives shall become widows, and your children fatherless. In verse 21, the word stranger in the New American Standard Bible is translated as alien in the NIV. So this verse is saying you shall not wrong an alien, somebody who's not a native Israelite and who's in the country. Now, that would include proselytes and temporary visitors. A temporary visitor would be somebody who just came in like on a tourist visa, to use modern terminology. He's just in the country briefly, and he comes out. That person is not likely going to be oppressed too much because he's not there long enough to get oppressed. But proselytes were in the country, and they were not full Hebrew citizens, and so they were subject to being treated badly, and so they were protected. Now, what kind of proselytes were they in Israel? There were two types. This is very well known, and it's in Wikipedia. Two types, and there's a lot of different names for the two types, but the most common names are this. One type is the proselyte of righteousness, and the other type is a proselyte of the gate. Now, the proselyte of righteousness, he kept all of the Jewish law. He was considered a full Jew. He was circumcised, and he was basically a Jew who was not born a Jew but came into the country and became a Jew by conforming to every aspect of the law. That's a proselyte of righteousness. Now, proselyte of the gate is somebody who kept only some of the Old Testament law, the so-called seven laws of Noah. They weren't required to be circumcised. They were resident aliens. They were in the country doing business and decided that they were so impressed by the Old Testament law, they wanted to be sort of like a God-fearer. They wanted to be partially under that law. But they weren't full citizens, and so they were subject to being oppressed. Aliens in foreign lands, even in modern times, are never as secure as natives. Ask any foreigner who's lived in China for a length of time. I lived over there for 23 years, and I was always just a little antsy. Do I have my passport? Oh, my gosh, the communists are listening to my email. They're reading my emails. They're listening on my phone. And so I was very careful what I said and what I said to whom. Oh, is the camera in the classroom? Is it turned on now? And so, yeah, in fact, I was screwed out of a job because some communists didn't like the fact that I was having a church meeting in my house on Sunday night because, you know, communists don't believe that there's a God. They're fools. But I wasn't doing anything against the communist government. I wasn't advocating revolution. I wasn't advocating that any person in that meeting violate the Chinese law. I was not saying anything bad about Chinese culture, which I happen to love. I was not saying anything bad about Chinese people, whom I also happen to love. I was just worshiping God, and they decide to kick me off the campus. Well, I was an alien in a strange land, and aliens don't have a lot of rights. But now, what does God's law say about aliens in Israel? You won't oppress him. Why? You used to be oppressed in the land of Egypt. You should know what it's like. You shall not afflict him. And if you do, what's going to happen to you? I'm going to kill you. Now, that doesn't mean he's going to take him to court. This is probably direct killing, pestilence, famine, attacked by enemy countries, by the sword. So God is very, very serious about treating aliens properly. Now, here's some, I'm not going to read them to you, but I've got list of laws all through the Old Testament scriptures and the New Testament that show God's concern for the weak and helpless. In the law of Moses and the psalmist and the prophets, I'm not going to read them to you. There's just too many of them. And how about Jesus? You know, if you came and saw me when I was in prison, you fed me when I was hungry, you clothed me when I was naked. That's one reason why Christianity is so attractive to the poor and the helpless, because this world is full of poverty and oppression. Now, Adam Clark says it was sound policy as well as justice to treat aliens well. Doing that would increase the strength of the country. And it will give a chance for aliens to learn about the true God, which is true. Now, verse 23 says, if you oppress the alien at all, if you afflict him at all, John Gill says about that, quote, in any way or by any means whatever, their minds, by reproaches, censures, insults, and their bodies, by stripes, false imprisonment, etc., and in their substance, by withholding from them what belongs to them, taking what they have, or cheating or defrauding them in any respect, you're going to die. Now, Adam Clark mentions what I just said. It's remarkable that God reserves the punishment of oppressors of the aliens to himself. He does not assign the punishment to civil judges. And by that, God shows how incredibly important it is not to oppress the defenseless. And I make this comment here. Notice that the punishment for oppressing the afflicted is the same punishment of death that is meted out to rebellious children, rapists, homosexuals, and practices of bestiality. And we might add to that list afflictors of aliens. This shows how much God cared for the weaker members of Hebrew society. Now, God says he's going to make these oppressors of the aliens, he's going to make their wives widows. So that's poetic justice for the oppressor. But what about the oppressor's wife? Let's assume she didn't do anything against the aliens. Well, the answer to that is they didn't live in an individualistic society. We often suffer what other people do through no fault of our own. And I'm telling you, wives suffer what their husbands do. Husbands and wives are a unit. That's why you need to be doggone careful when you get married to somebody, because you're not in this world alone. You can't say, well, I'm just rooming with my wife. No, what she does affects you, and what you do affects her. I remember so well. A guy that I went to high school with, I hadn't seen in years, calls me up. I'd hired his wife without knowing, his ex-wife without knowing it. And he called me up. He found out where she was, and he says, Dan, she's gone out with my credit card, and she's charged $10,000 to it. And I said, I hate to tell you, you're liable for it. And that's true. You are liable for the acts of your spouse, even in modern times. So that's unfortunate, but that's the way it is. We go to Exodus 22, verses 25 through 27. If you lend money to my people, to the poor among you, you are not to act as a creditor to him. You shall not charge him interest. If you ever take your neighbor's cloak as a pledge, you are to return it to him before the sun sets. For that is his only covering. It is his cloak for his body. What else shall he sleep in? And it shall come about that when he cries out to me, I will hear him, for I am gracious. Now this is the famous passage that's against usury or interest, and it is amazing to me how great theologians in the Catholic Church during the Middle Ages can't read the scriptures with common sense. For first of all, they said that we were all subject to the Mosaic law, which we weren't. So just on that grounds, you could say, well, then the prohibition against interest does not apply to medieval Christians, just like it does not apply to modern day Christians. That's the first thing. The second thing is most all of the prohibitions in the Old Testament against interest refer to loans to the poor, not to some hotshot entrepreneur who's trying to expand his business overseas and needs $1 million from some financial angel, some investor, some venture capitalist. These were not business loans, ladies and gentlemen. Verse 25 says, if you lend money to my people, to the poor among you, you're not to charge them interest. They're so-called charity loans. It's amazing why big shot theologians throughout the centuries have not been able to notice that. This is not business loans. There's nothing wrong with lending money on business. I mean, even today, there are banks in America who cater to Islamic businessmen who can't pay interest because Islam does the same things as interest is not to be paid on a business loan, which is absurd. And so the banks go to all kinds of legerdemain to pretend that they're not charging interest. Of course they're charging interest, but otherwise they wouldn't make the loan. And I forgot exactly how they do it. One way you can do it is on a $100,000 loan, you just fork out $90,000 and say, pay me back $100,000 at no interest. Well, actually, you've charged interest. It's just not on the face of the instrument. Anyway, this is the kind of stuff that's gone on all throughout history as people have tried to get around ridiculous theological prohibitions against interest. The prohibition was against lending money to poor people and charging them interest. This is a matter of charity, not business. Now, let me read you some of the scriptures dealing with usury, and I'm going to try to point out as I go through that it's involving the poor in most of these. Leviticus 25, 35 through 37. Now, in case of a countryman of yours becomes poor, and his means with regard to you falter, then you are to sustain him like a stranger or sojourner that he may live with you. Do not take usurious interest from him. From who? From the poor. Verse 37, you shall not give him your silver at interest. That's in Leviticus 25. Deuteronomy 15, 7 through 11. If there is a poor man with you, one of your brothers, you shall not close your hand from your poor brother. But you shall freely open your hand to him and generously lend to him. It's a loan, but it's a charity loan to the poor for his need. Beware that there is no base thought in your heart, saying, the seventh year, the year of remission, is near, and your eye is hostile towards your poor brother. What that means is the year of remission is every 7 years, all debts were remitted. And you might think, oh, if I lend him money, he's got 6 months, and pretty soon all of his debts are going to be wiped out, so I'm not going to lend him any money because his debt to me will be wiped out and I'll lose the money. Nope. The law says you give him the money, you give him the loan anyway. Again, this is really charity. You shall generously give to him, and your heart shall not be grieved when you give to him, because for this thing the Lord your God will bless you in all your work and all your undertakings. For the poor will never cease to be in the land. Therefore I command you, saying, you shall freely open your hand to your brother, to your needy, and poor in your land. The poor will never cease to be in the land. These are charity loans. And let me stop right here in the middle to say that there's plenty of places where there's poor people. I think about Africa, and I think about all the people down there drinking this nasty water. There's people down there that can build wells just to give some people some water. And they don't cost an all that much, you know. All these million-dollar crystal cathedral-type buildings and mega churches and all the mortgage interest paid on that, just a little bit could be used to buy a well to help poor people down there have some water to drink. Well, anyway, Deuteronomy 23, 19 through 20. You shall not charge interest to your countrymen, interest on money, food, or anything that may be loaned in interest. You may charge interest to a foreigner, but to your countrymen you shall not charge interest. So Israelites got the best deal here. And by the way, that shows that charity is not promiscuous. You don't have to give money to everybody. You give money to people that are close to you, that you care about. Like if it's Christians in Africa, well, we don't have Israel anymore. That's gone. But we do have brothers in Christ overseas. If we make an application there, Nehemiah 5, 7 through 12. I consulted with myself and contended with the nobles and the rulers and said to them, you are exacting usury, each from his brother. Therefore, I held a great assembly against them. I said to them, we, according to our ability, this is Nehemiah building the walls about mid-5th century B.C., in restored Israel after the Babylonian captivity. We, according to our ability, have redeemed our Jewish brothers who were sold to the nations. Now would you even sell your brothers that they may be sold to us? In other words, you make a loan to the poor, they can't pay you back, so then you sell them to slavery to get paid back. They were silent, could not find a word to say. Again, I said, Nehemiah said, the thing which you're doing is not good. And let me skip down here. And likewise I, my brothers and my servants, are lending them money and grain. Please let us leave off this usury. So Nehemiah blast usury. It doesn't mention the poor, but that's what it was. Job 24:9, others snatch the orphan from the breast, and against the poor they take a pledge. Pledge is collateral for a loan to the poor. Not supposed to make loans to the poor, Job says. Proverbs 28:8, he who increases his wealth by interest and usury gathers it up for him who is gracious to the poor. The implication here is the one who is gracious to the poor is the one who does not lend to the poor at interest. Ezekiel 18:13, he lends money on interest and takes increase. Will he live? He will not live. Ooh, a usurer will be killed. He has committed all these abominations. He will surely be put to death. His blood will be on his own head. Now, you're going to put a banker to death because he lends money to a business? No. This is talking about people who are oppressing the poor. Exodus 22:12, in you they have taken bribes to shed blood. You have taken interest in profits. You have injured your neighbors for gain by oppressions, and you have forgotten me. And by the way, these left-wing evangelicals who drive me crazy, they like to quote these kind of verses, you know, and say, therefore it's a sin for people, for businesses, for people to lend money. I don't know if they do this, but their tendency is to say, oh, you know, you shouldn't lend money to a business. You should invest in a corporation, blah, 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 blah. No. There's nothing wrong with interest. There's nothing wrong with profits. Ezekiel 22:12, you have taken interest in profits, and then you're said to be an oppressor. And so then people say, see, their profits are a badge of oppression. Left-wing Marxist Jim Wallace type of morons. No, that's not what it's talking about. Now, with a charity loan, in effect, a gift is made of the interest, not the principal, because the poor person has to pay the principal back without interest. Now, in the modern West, we don't have this. We just give charity outright, and we don't expect anything to be paid back. You know, I think Habitat for Humanity kind of has this idea. They give a lot to the poor person, but they expect the poor person to put some sweat equity into the house. There's a good reason for this, to ask the poor to participate, because it is humiliating to take money. I have had lots of experience with it. In fact, I have decided that it's just about as hard to give charity as it is to live on it. Because what happens is the person that you're giving money to starts to feel dependent, and then pretty soon they start getting resentful, and pretty soon they bite the hand that feeds them. I've seen this over and over again, and I've taken the approach, and I don't care how all these missionary organizations say, you know, if you would just pledge a certain amount every month, the missionary could rationalize his budget and he can depend on stuff. I don't care. I give pieces of money at random intervals so that nobody knows when it's coming or when it's coming, because I am not going to make somebody dependent on me, because I've seen what happens, and it's not pleasant, folks. Give people money as a gift, but don't give it to them, because it creates strings and it makes people feel like they are welfare recipients and they don't have any dignity and so forth. The poor need dignity as well as they need money. Now, one word about this term usury. Well, actually, the New American Standard Bible doesn't have the term usury in here. It says interest, but the word is usury. The old-fashioned word is usury. The literal Hebrew there, as Adam Clark says, is biting usury or devouring usury. So we could read it like this. You shall not charge him biting usury or devouring usury. And that leaves open to the possibility that you can charge him reasonable usury, reasonable interest. I don't think that's right. I think it means no usury at all, whether it's reasonable, unreasonable, The NIV Study Bible on the relevant passage in Leviticus 25, verses 36 through 37 says that you shall not take excessive interest. Well, that sounds like you can take interest on a charity loan. I don't believe that. I believe when you give your money to the poor, you give the interest completely, 100%. You don't take a little bit of interest. You don't take any interest, zero interest, in my humble opinion. Because I think that what the scripture means here, that biting usury or devouring usury, it means that all usury is devouring. You should not charge him usury, which is devouring. I think that's what the text means. My humble opinion. Now, there's a little bit about collateral here in verse 26, which says, if you ever take your neighbor's cloak as a pledge, that's collateral. You don't pay me back, I keep your cloak. You are to return it to him before the sun sets. Now, this is unusual. Who ever heard of revolving collateral? Put collateral on your car, and the bank says, well, we'll let you have, we're going to take your car during the daytime, but at nighttime we'll let you have it back so you can go to work. But then you need to give it back to us at night when you're sleeping. You don't need it. That would be, you know, that's pretty weird. So I asked myself the question, what kind of security is this? It seems to me that any pledge that has to be returned at night is not security for a loan at all. The debtor could just refuse to give the cloak back the next day. He says, now I've got your money, creditor, and now I've got your collateral. I got them both. You ain't got it. Nothing you can do. And I ask myself, well, why doesn't the law just say that charity loans should be unsecured? If you lend money to the poor, by golly, if they don't pay you back, it's your risk. Well, here's a possible answer to that problem from Adam Clark. He says that the daily return of collateral served as a formal acknowledgement of the debt, which served evidentiary purposes, so that everybody would know that the poor debtor owed the creditor money. This is especially necessary when writing was not common. So I guess if you're poor and you have to give up your cloak every day while you go to work, you have to, and you know, people are going to see this. It shows that you owe money, and you might want to get out of that by paying the loan back as soon as your fortunes turn around. We go now to Exodus 22, verse 28. You shall not curse God, nor curse a ruler of your people. Now, this verse has actually been quoted by Paul when he unwittingly insulted a high priest in Acts 23, 4 through 5. But the bystander says, do you revile God's priest? That was Ananias. And Paul said, I was not aware, brethren, that he was high priest. Paul called him a whitewashed sepulcher. I think the high priest servant, if I remember correctly, slapped Paul upside the head. And Paul calls him a whitewashed sepulcher. And Paul said, I was not aware, brethren, that he was high priest, for it is written. And now Paul quotes Exodus 22:28, you shall not speak evil of a ruler of your people. Now, actually, in the New American Standard Bible, Exodus 22:28 says, you shall not curse God. Paul quotes the verse as saying, you shall not speak evil of a ruler. You shall not curse a ruler. Well, other translations don't have God there. You shall not curse God. KJV has, you shall not curse the gods. Adam Clark says that most commentators take that word there to be the civil magistrates. You shall not curse the gods, because we know that gods are often referred to as judges in the Old Testament. That's well known. The NIV note has it translated this way, do not revile the judges. Now, this is instructive. You should never get a judge mad at you. Not if you've got any sense in your head. You should never get a king mad at you. Here's a good verse from Ecclesiastes 10, verse 20. Furthermore, in your bedchamber, do not curse a king, and in your sleeping rooms, do not curse a rich man. For a bird of the heavens will carry the sound, and the winged creature will make the matter known. In other words, if you are under authority, either of a king or a rich person, or if you are in business and you have a boss, you never say anything bad about the boss. That's management 101. Rule number one, don't do it. Don't say anything bad about your supervisor or your CEO or the president of your company. Don't say anything bad to your colleagues, to your subordinates, to your immediate supervisor. Keep your mouth shut. In fact, probably good not to say anything to your wife if you're scared she's going to divorce you and go work for that company. Don't do it. I'm exaggerating, of course. You got to have somebody to ventilate to, and your wife's probably the best one to do that too. But that's just, I mean, it's pragmatic as well as moral. Surely you shouldn't curse rulers. That's a moral thing, but also pragmatic, because they're going to come get you. It's human nature. Now, when it says don't curse your rulers, does that mean a subject of Adolf Hitler cannot oppose Adolf Hitler? Of course not. Of course that's not what the verse means. It merely means that one should not rebel. One should not rebel against lawfully constituted authority. And Adolf Hitler, my friends, does not qualify for that. I believe in John Calvin when he says you can revolt against unjust authority. I believe in it thoroughly. I think sometimes it might be necessary. Even here in the United States of Sodom and Gomorrah, it depends on how far the secularist, atheist, petty little antichrist who run our government now tend to harass the church. They're already starting to oppress it and demonize it and marginalize it. And of course, that's just laying the groundwork for when actual laws will come. Oh, excuse me, the state of California just passed a law saying that you cannot have a prayer meeting in your house. Oh. The Supreme Court, by a vote of 5-4, overturned that law, but that was close. It's coming. They're going to start overstepping their authority. And the question is, well, should I curse them? Oh, no, you shouldn't curse them. You should obey them when they say drive on the right side of the road and when they perform the normal functions of government. But when they start trenching upon your relationship with Jesus Christ, you can tell them, kindly invite them to go to the place of eternal theological punishment. We go now to Exodus 22, verses 29 through 30. You shall not delay the offering from your harvest and your vintage. The firstborn of your sons you shall give to me. You shall do the same with your oxen and with your sheep. It shall be with its mother 7 days. On the eighth day you shall give it to me. Now this is the law of the firstborn. It's very well known even before the law. Let's look at Exodus 4:22. Then you shall say to Pharaoh, thus says the Lord, Israel is my son, my firstborn. This is the reason for the law of firstborn, because Israel was God's firstborn. Israel was redeemed from slavery, and so therefore firstborns have to be redeemed ever since. Sort of as an object lesson to the Israelites. Why are we doing this? Because Israel was bought out of slavery from Egypt. Exodus 13:2. Again, before the law, sanctify to me, God says, every firstborn, the first offspring of every womb among the sons of Israel, both of man and beast, it belongs to me. Now, Exodus 22:20 repeats that law that I just read in Exodus 13:2. Note that the offering of the firstborn was done from the very beginning, even before the law. In Genesis 4:4, Abel, on his part, also brought of the firstlings, the firstborn, the firstlings of his flock and of their fat portions. And the Lord had regard for Abel and for his offering. We read in Exodus 13:13, but every first offspring of a donkey you shall redeem with a lamb. Redeem, it means you just pay the value of it to the priest, to God. They didn't have a priestly system there, but I'm not exactly sure how you redeemed it before the tabernacle and the legal system got set up, but maybe they just offered it. You sacrifice the lamb rather than the donkey. If you do not redeem it, if you do not redeem the donkey, you shall break its neck. In other words, it's God's. You think you're going to keep it? Nope, you don't keep it. You have to break its neck, so you're going to lose it. And every firstborn of man among your sons you shall redeem. Now, again, I repeat, the reason for all this is God had spared all the firstborn of the Israelites from the 10th plague, the death that went marching across the land, killing the firstborn of all the Egyptians. So therefore, because the Israelites were delivered from that, they belong to God. Now the first fruits came from grain and also from the vintage. Verse 29, the NIV says, translates that as your granaries or your vats. And a note says the meaning of the Hebrew for this phrase is uncertain, but granaries and vats sounds good to me. Firstborn of your grain, firstborn of your grapes. Now a firstborn animal could not be offered for the first 7 days. Only on the eighth day was to be offered to God. Why is that? Adam Clark says it was necessary for the mother's health that the mother nurse the little firstborn animal for 7 days. It was necessary for her health, probably to relieve the pressure of her enlarged paps. And also the nursing for the 7 days was for the health of the lamb. We go now to our last verse in this chapter, Exodus 22:31. You shall be holy men to me, therefore you shall not eat any flesh torn to pieces in the field. You shall throw it to the dogs. Now this prohibition against eating torn flesh was later instituted in the law for priests. Leviticus 22:8, he, meaning a priest, shall not eat an animal which dies or is torn by beasts, becoming unclean by it. I am the Lord. There's another scripture that refers to people in general, Leviticus 17:15. When any person eats an animal which dies or is torn by beast, whether he is a native or an alien, he shall wash his clothes and bathe in water and remain unclean until evening. Then he will become clean. Now, the logical question here is why? What is the reason for this rule? Adam Clark says it's so that the people would not eat blood. You eat an animal whose flesh has been torn to pieces, which means there's going to be blood in that flesh. Blood was symbolic of life. Life is in the blood, Leviticus 19. All the Old Testament ritual was centered on blood. Life, blood, had to be given for life in satisfaction for guilt. Life for life, blood for blood. So they were sacrificed, killed in the stead of the guilty Hebrews. So to casually eat blood would thus profane its ceremonial function. So you don't eat flesh torn to pieces. Ladies and gentlemen, we are now finished with Exodus chapter 22. In our next audio, we will turn to Exodus chapter 23. I'm going to do the first 19 verses. We will cover slander, perjury, bribery, the Sabbath, and the Jewish festivals. I hope you don't get bogged down in all this legal stuff. You might not like it, but I love it. But anyway, for the curious, I hope you'll be with me next time. I hope you enjoyed this audio. We'll see you next time.